Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, August 14, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss the third-party doctrine as being considered in the Supreme Court case Carpenter v. United States. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Jim Harper, who is Vice President at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, as well as Orrin S. Kerr, Fred C. Stevenson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. We're going to begin with Orrin's opening remarks, and then we will move, then we'll have Jim give remarks and have a discussion there, and then eventually move to an audience Q&A. Thank you both for speaking with us. Orrin, the floor is now yours.
Thank you, Wes. Happy to be here, and thank you to Jim for joining us as well. I wanted to first talk about the facts of the Carpenter case and the legal issue, and then offer some thoughts about what the Supreme Court should do before turning it over to Jim. So this is a pretty simple case factually. It involved a string of robberies that occurred over a two-year period. A bunch of guys would go into cell phone stores armed with guns, and they would order the customers to the back and take the phones. Carpenter, the defendant in this case, was the lead organizer of the conspiracy, and he often gave the guns and acted as a lookout and would signal when the robbery was to start. The key issue in this case is whether the government needed a warrant under the Fourth Amendment to obtain the cell site records that related to Carpenter's use of his cell phone. So the group used phones. They were in communication with each other during the robberies, and because of the way cell phones work, that meant that their phones were sending communications to their cellular providers, basically saying, I'm over here, here's how you route the call to me, and then the cell providers would route the communications to the calls with their local towers. And the cell phone companies generate records, which they keep in the ordinary course of business, as basically a record of which tower was used to communicate with a particular phone at a particular time. Those records then can be later accessed by the government in order to provide a rough sense of where a person was located at that particular time, assuming people are with their phones. They're probably in their hands or in their pockets at the time a communication comes in or is sent. And so the government was able to assemble information about the conspiracy, show that Carpenter was in the same rough location of his co-conspirators, always at the point of where the robbery was occurring at the time the robberies did occur, and use that against Carpenter. The government used a federal statutory privacy law called the Stored Communications Act to get those records. The Stored Communications Act says that in order to get non-content records about a telephone or internet account, the government needs specific and articulable facts that information to be obtained from the records are relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. This is basically the Terry versus Ohio reasonable suspicion standards in the Fourth Amendment written into the statutory privacy law. Importantly, though, the government did not get a probable cause search warrant under the Fourth Amendment. And the question in the case really boils down to, did the government need to get a probable cause warrant under the Fourth Amendment, or does the Fourth Amendment not apply, and is the privacy protection here just from the statute? The Fourth Amendment issue really boils down to whether a person has Fourth Amendment rights in their cell site data that is generated and kept by their cellular providers. The Fourth Amendment provides that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. That's the key phrase. And then no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. The first issue in Carpenter is, was there a search of Carpenter's persons, houses, papers, and effects? Was there a search of his stuff? or was it only a search of the company stuff? And really, did Carpenter have any Fourth Amendment rights in those records, or was it really just the company's rights? And then second, if Carpenter did have rights, what is the Fourth Amendment standard for getting access to those records? Is it a probable cause warrant, or is the statutory standard sufficient under the Fourth Amendment? The reason why Carpenter is a really important case is that it raises what a lot of people refer to as the third-party doctrine, which is this idea that the Fourth Amendment doesn't protect information that is knowingly exposed to third parties. If you go out in public, you can't complain when people see you in public. If you talk to someone and say, hey, I committed this crime, you can't complain when the government goes to that person and says, what did he just say to you? And upon voluntarily disclosing this information, exposing information to an outsider, you lose Fourth Amendment rights in that, and the government can then go to that person and say, hey, what did you just see, or what did that person just tell you? The government's argument is that this traditional third-party doctrine applies, and that basically these are the phone company's records about what the phone company did for the user. They're not the user's records. They're not the user's property. They're the phone company's property. And because this information was revealed by the user to the phone company in the course of creating a contract in order to send and receive communications, the government is allowed to go to the eyewitness of the phone company, essentially, and get those records without triggering the Fourth Amendment rights of the user. Statutory rights, we all agree, are in play, but the government would say not the constitutional rights. The flip argument is that the Fourth Amendment should be understood to create rights for users in their records of what they did. And there are a bunch of different theories for how to get there. Under the traditional third-party doctrine, which the lower courts relied on, we would say there are no Fourth Amendment rights in that information. That information has been knowingly revealed. And so the question in Carpenter is whether the Supreme Court should reject the third-party doctrine, should modify the third-party doctrine, and come up with a way to say that people can have rights in records of other people, other entities about what they did. So that's the basic framing of the case. We've seen Carpenter's case has been filed. Carpenter's brief relies heavily, not exclusively, but heavily on the concurring opinions in United States versus Jones and its so-called mosaic theory. The idea being that when the government collects information that shows what you've been doing over time, then at some point, short-term monitoring is not a search, but at some point, the government collects enough stuff that they really get insights about you, and a search has occurred. This is an argument suggested by the five concurring justices in Jones. It has not been adopted by a majority of the Supreme Court. Carpenter's brief urges the court to adopt that theory as a majority view, and it applies it, unlike Jones, to pre-existing records. So Jones was the case involving the installation of a GPS device on a car and tracking the GPS device in its location for 28 days. And Justice Alito, in his concurring opinion, says the government is learning so much stuff about somebody over a course of 28 days. At some point before 28 days, that becomes a search. The government has learned so much information. Carpenter is basically saying, hey, okay, Justice Alito, you said that for Jones and GPS devices, apply that to cell site records. And in the cell site context, it wouldn't be the government collecting records over time. It would be the government going to the provider and saying, give us the long-term records showing, I think in this case it was 172 days or 127 days, some over 100 days, a long window of time. Carpenter says, yeah, if you collected cell site records for a short period of time, that would not be a search, but you collected records that covered a long period of time. And so you were able to learn a lot of information about Carpenter, and that was sort of collectively at some point a search. So one of the issues in Carpenter is just, is the Supreme Court going to buy, as a majority view, this mosaic theory? My own view, to turn to my take on this, I don't see how they can adopt a mosaic theory as a majority view. It's a completely unadministrable view to say that some things are not a search, other things are a search, and then there's some sort of line as to which point things become a search. I've asked a lot of people who are fans of this theory, where would you draw the lines? And there's tremendous reluctance to draw the lines that the courts would have to draw, which collection methods trigger the mosaic theory? How long can the mosaic theory apply? What's the half-life of the mosaic search? What are the remedies for a mosaic search? Lots and lots of administrative problems. I suspect if the Supreme Court sort of has to confront this, which Carpenter is asking them to, they will not want to rely on this sort of too much becomes a search theory. It's just too hard to figure out where those lines are. That's though the main argument that has been raised by Carpenter's side. We don't have the government's brief in the Supreme Court yet. I suspect the government will argue that the court should retain the traditional third-party doctrine. My own view is that that's right, although to see why, you kind of have to realize some weird turns in the doctrine over the last 30 or 40 years. Here's, I think, the basic problem. I think we can all kind of agree that the Fourth Amendment question of what is a search raises sort of two different issues. First, what kinds of spaces are protected under the Fourth Amendment? You know, a home is protected, something that occurs in public is not protected. And then also, once something is protected, you can open it to the public and mean that it's not protected in a specific context. So my home is protected by the Fourth Amendment, but if I open my doors and say, everybody come in, not protected under the Fourth Amendment. These are those two kind of key questions as to what is a search. I think what happened is that that distinction between those two ideas, what is protected and when is it protected, by kind of a waiver theory, got lost in a misunderstanding of what Justice Harlan was doing in his concurring opinion in Katz versus United States. If you read Harlan's opinion closely, and it's important because the court later adopts Harlan's view, the reasonable expectation of privacy idea is just something is a private space that merits Fourth Amendment protection when society is prepared to recognize that expectation of it being a private home-like space as reasonable. So as applied in the Katz case, a phone booth, once you go in the phone booth, you close the door, you put in your nickel and make your call. During the period of that call, that's like your home, and that's why you have Fourth Amendment rights in it. And so the idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy was just saying, listen, we can't really accurately identify what exactly is home-like and what is not home-like. That's a kind of a social norms question. That's like what is treated like a home. And so we're going to say it's up to society's view as to what is sort of home-like enough to be treated like a home for Fourth Amendment purposes. The trick, to my mind, and what makes this the Carpenter case difficult or sort of analytically confusing, is that the Supreme Court misunderstood the third-party doctrine and moved the doctrinal box of the test in a way that creates a lot of confusion. Originally, the idea that when you disclose information to a third party, you give up your Fourth Amendment rights in it, that was the subjective expectation of privacy test. The idea was you need to manifest your subjective expectation of privacy by shielding information from outsiders. If you disclose information to outsiders, you can't retain Fourth Amendment rights in that information. And so that was the subjective expectation of privacy test. In a series of cases in the 70s and the 80s, once the court adopts the Katz test as the Fourth Amendment search doctrine, the Supreme Court, instead of realizing that's the point of the subjective expectation privacy test, they just start rephrasing that same concept in terms of reasonable expectations of privacy. And they say, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy when you knowingly disclose information to a third party. And a lot of people hear that and they go, wait a minute, I reasonably expect privacy when I disclose information to third parties all the time. I expect them to keep my secrets, and so I do have a reasonable expectation of privacy. What the court should have said is, when you reveal information to a third party, you're not manifesting your subjective expectations of privacy, which means, really, the Carpenter case is not about reasonable expectations of privacy. It is about manifesting a subjective expectation of privacy. And so a lot of the briefs talk about reasonable expectations of privacy and what is a reasonable expectation of privacy. I think that's not the question in the Carpenter case, because the Supreme Court just mixed up these two doctrinal boxes. So it'd be really helpful to just set straight that this is really a subjective expectation of privacy case, not a reasonable expectation of privacy case. And the whole third party doctrine is really just this traditional idea, which goes back, 100 years easily, that when you reveal information to someone, you can't then expect Fourth Amendment privacy in it. You don't get Fourth Amendment rights in that which you have revealed to a third party. My own view is that the Supreme Court should stick to that traditional view. The role of the subjective expectation of privacy test should be retained, in part because it's hard to come up with the administrable line where you can reveal information to somebody and yet get Fourth Amendment rights in what you've told them. When do you have that right? So this is a sort of free-form really make it up as you go along, constitutional law, to try to come up with what that limit should be. And I think it's essential to maintaining the Fourth Amendment in sort of mapping, translating the principles of the Fourth Amendment from the physical world to the network world by saying in the context of non-content information, like records that a provider is generating about what they did for you on a network, to say that that's not protected. Because that's the equivalent information of what you would do in public in the physical world. What the network is doing is basically bringing communications that you would have to bring in public to you, instead of you having to talk to go meet with your co-conspirator. The cell provider is sending your communication to them and generating records about how they're doing that, basically substituting for information that used to be public. And so I think to maintain the balance of the Fourth Amendment, you'd want to say that non-con information should not be protected. You'd want to keep that idea of you need to manifest a subjective expectation of privacy, and that retains the traditional role of the Fourth Amendment when you map from a physical world to a network world, and is consistent with traditional Fourth Amendment principles, albeit through the subjective expectation of privacy test, not the reasonable expectation of privacy test. So that's at least how I think the Supreme Court should resolve the case. I think it's impossible to know what the justices will do at this point. It's really, really hard to predict this case, in part because the Supreme Court has not decided a case on a third-party doctrine since any of the justices on the current Supreme Court have been on the Supreme Court. So we don't know what the justices are going to want to do. They're not going to have a lot of cases for them to look back on their prior decisions to sort of have some continuity with their prior work. Kind of anyone's bet as to what I think the Supreme Court would do. And so with that long summary, I'd love to turn it over to Jim.
Thank you, Oren, and a very capable summary of the case and many of the issues. There's going to be no shortage of stuff to talk about during this hour. So thanks for setting that up. Thanks to the Federalist Society, Wes, and all the folks that have dialed in to this call. Sure appreciate your interest in hearing about this stuff. I'll say that I think that Carpenter probably wins. The question is how? And that's the really difficult question. Is the court going to go with the reasonable expectation of privacy test? It might, but I think there are good reasons and good chances that it might not. The court hasn't actually used the reasonable expectation of privacy test as its decision rule in a very long time. Important recent cases like Kelo in 2001 on through to Riley, a cell phone case decided just a couple of years ago, didn't rely on the reasonable expectation of privacy test. The Jones case dealing with GPS devices attached to vehicles didn't rely on the reasonable expectation of privacy test, though a number of the justices would have used it as their decision. I would like the court to move from confusing doctrine like the reasonable expectation of privacy test back toward something more like applying the terms of the Fourth Amendment literally to the facts of cases. The reasonable expectation of privacy test in an amicus brief that I filed with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Cato Institute, Reason Foundation, and our fourth petitioner, the Committee for Justice, it argued that the reasonable expectation of privacy test is a sociological method for applying the Fourth Amendment, and it's not a juridical or legal method. That is, it asks the court, nine justices who certainly will dedicate their honest effort to it, to figure out what the entire society thinks is appropriate in terms of privacy, and making that exercise even more difficult is the fact that we're talking about new technology in which privacy expectations aren't actually settled. So do we expect the Supreme Court or lower courts to be expert sociologists, or do we expect them to apply the law to facts in given cases? The reasonable expectation of privacy test, as Oren ably described, came from Justice Harlan's concurrence in Katz, 1967. His solo concurrence, which wasn't necessary to the outcome of the case, mused, in my opinion, about how the previous cases tended to suggest that the court would look at whether a person subjectively had an expectation of privacy, and then if objectively that was a reasonable thing to have. Well, good effort, but that actually wasn't the majority's rationale. The majority decided, based on the fact that Katz had concealed himself in a phone booth, and that phone booth concealed the sound of his voice from others, literally stopping sound waves from moving to where they could be heard by a stranger. Capturing those sound waves using a bug was in my point of view, a seizure of the sound waves and converting them to audible form later would be an arguable search. But the reasonable expectation of privacy doctrine for now almost 40 years has held sway, and there are all kinds of derivative doctrines that flow from it. One that I find particularly difficult to stomach is the notion that a search aimed at illegal behavior or possession of drugs, for example, is not a search. In drug-sniffing dog cases, for example, there's no expectation of privacy. Society wouldn't accept it in possession of illegal drugs. So having somebody examined quite thoroughly by a drug-sniffing dog, which arguably only turns up indications of illegal drugs, that's not a search. Well, according to that logic, someone could be examined quite carefully hourly or daily, every time they entered a given building or, routinely. No matter what the circumstances, that would not be a Fourth Amendment search. Well, that's the logical upshot of the reasonable expectation of privacy test, but I don't think it makes very much sense. The third-party doctrine is a similar, really, really challenging outgrowth of reasonable expectation of privacy doctrine. And it says that if you've shared something with a third party, you don't expect privacy in it, so you don't have Fourth Amendment rights. In a lot of cases, you don't see very good analysis of the sociology that's involved. And Smith versus Maryland is a good example where the court only considered reasons why people wouldn't have an expectation of privacy in information about their telephone dialing. The court did not write about, at least, any countervailing indications, any suggestion that people actually do have or might have an expectation of privacy in their phone dialing information, which could be objectively reasonable. So the third-party doctrine is a subsidiary doctrine from this reasonable expectation of privacy doctrine, which is essentially a sociological exercise. My strong preference would be for the court to return to the terms of the Fourth Amendment, and almost as if a law student writing about this, I've said the court should examine whether or not there was a search, whether or not there was a seizure, whether or not it pertained to the items listed in the Fourth Amendment, persons, houses, papers, and effects. There's an important question of ownership. The possessive pronoun there is used to circumscribe what things people may assert their rights in. But then if you find that there was a seizure or search of protected things, you ask whether it was reasonable. And almost always a warrant is required in the absence of exigency or a few other circumstances. In this case, I think it's fairly clear that there was a seizure. The operation of the Stored Communications Act requires telecommunications providers to turn over data based on the low standard, essentially the Terry standard, as Oren correctly said. And if they don't do it, they'll be punished. I think there's just no argument that that isn't a seizure of data. Converting the data into something that humans can read is a search. That's a detail that's not important for this case, but it may be important in other cases that conversion of digital material into something humans can see is what makes it available to people. You've searched it when you've converted it from digital into some analog form, and that's an upshot of the Kelo case, where a thermal imager converted the invisible heat waves off of a house into the visible spectrum. Oren Kerr himself, in an excellent article on the topic, suggested that that's when a search occurs, is when a signal is converted from something that humans can't perceive into something that they could perceive. Then there's the question of papers or effects. It's a little bit much to swallow for many people still today that digital items can be papers, but I think that the understanding of papers, there is the restrictive understanding that papers are a certain form factor of cellulose and that only 8.5 by 11 inch flat sheets made from wood pulp count as papers, but there are other contemporaneous definitions contemporaneous at the founding that treated papers as that corpus of collections of information, that the things that where you kept information that were important to you. So that's a way of understanding that papers refers to information collections as opposed to just strictly things made of paper. And for example, in U.S. versus Boyd, the court talked about invoices and papers, books, invoices, and papers. And if you were to take the restrictive reading of papers, you would say that the court was saying three times papers, papers, and papers. But in fact, under a more appropriate broad reading of papers, it's information storage tools. So courts across the land, of course, treat digital materials today as documents or papers when it comes time for discovery and that kind of thing. We really do recognize, I think, in the law, and it's only a matter of time before the court says explicitly that digital documents are papers as much as any physical literal paper documents are. But then, of course, there's the question of who owns these papers. And here's where the third-party doctrine, I think, has its worst effects, because courts don't actually consider very carefully. They say, well, the doctrine says that it's been shared with a third party, so all bets are off. But I think the doctrine has a lot of explaining to do, because in the digital environment, there's a huge mass of legal agreements going to the status of data in terms of ownership. Those are terms of service and privacy policies that in rather excruciating detail indicate who can do what with data. And I think that's best treated as allocation of property rights in data. Almost always the possessory interest in the data rests with the service provider. That is, here the phone companies T-Mobile and Metro PCS have possession of the data, but they have committed themselves through their contracts not to share the data other than as specified. Now, so they'll share it with certain service providers. They'll be able to use it for purposes of protecting and improving their network. And appropriately, they will share it with law enforcement when they're met with a valid process requiring them to share it. But they don't have the right to share it under anything other than a valid process. So the question really becomes, is the process valid? When the process is debatable, as it is here, and I know there will be cases where it's clearly a valid process, and in that case the service provider has the right to share it. But when it's debatable, as it is here, and you can't share it with the criminal suspect because that would give away the fact of the investigation, the thing you should do is go to a neutral arbiter. And, of course, the next step in the analysis, I think, requires exactly that. Because you've got yourself a seizure, you've got yourself a search, it's papers in effect in which the defendants here, the petitioners, have a property interest. The remaining question is whether it's reasonable to have seized or searched those things without a warrant. And the general rule that's suggested strongly by the terms of the Fourth Amendment itself and that the Supreme Court's cases back up is that in the absence of exigency, you should go and get a warrant. And this is a case where the data is at rest with established service providers who are planning to keep it for a long time. There's really no risk of the data disappearing. So that slight additional hurdle of going to get a warrant when the risk is great that all of us, our data about our comings and goings, will be handed over to the government willy-nilly, that's the right time for this warrant requirement. So that's the thing I'd like the court to do. Whether it actually does this, we'll just have to see. But let me throw it back to Oren, and let's see if we can find some interesting nuggets to talk about.
Thanks, Jim. So that was terrific. Let me focus on where I think we disagree most directly with respect to your theory, because I read your very interesting brief last night in preparation for this. And here's where I think we disagree. I think we both agree that records are constitutional papers. They're electronically stored, but that still counts as papers for Fourth Amendment purposes. I think we just disagree as to whose papers they are. So I would say that the phone companies generated records about what they did for the customer were the phone company's records, not the user's records. And they don't have a property right. It's not their record, it's a property idea. It's the phone company's records. You take two steps, and I want to focus on both of them. The first one is to say that the contract should govern. That is, the language of the terms of service between the phone company and the user should govern who has property rights. Effectively, when the company says, "Here are your rights as to when we're going to disclose your information," you get property rights in that information, as long as they have kind of promised to not disclose it too much or under certain circumstances. So that's the first idea. And the second is specifically that the language used in these contracts creates this property right. And let me focus on the first question first. So it seems odd to me to say that you can get a property right in something by virtue of somebody promising not to disclose information they've generated about you. So, for example, let's say I want to rob a bank and I want you to be the lookout, to be a lookout, and I say, I'll give you $10 to be a lookout on the condition that you promise to never tell anyone what you saw or what you did for me. It would seem a little odd for me to say, if I understand you correctly, that that would create a property right that I would own in your recollection of what you did for me by virtue of our agreement. And one problem, I think, with having that property right theory based on contract is that it enables anyone who wants to commit a crime to just contract around with everyone, to basically ensure a warrant requirement for everything they do in public or they share with anyone, because the government will need a warrant because they have all these property rights and the information. So that's a concern I have on the first point. On the second point, it seems to me that the actual language of the terms of service in this case, assuming that that is actually the binding thing, it's a pretty mushy piece of language. You know, as you say, it allows disclosure for legal process. And I would have to think that a 2703D order signed by a federal judge that is enforced by federal law, that counts as legal process, as an actual court order signed by a judge. And so I would think that, first of all, that the language here allows the process. This counts as legal process. So the provider has not promised to keep a secret in these exact circumstances, because that's what federal law provides. And then second, that more broadly, I have trouble with this idea that you kind of contract property rights and privacy effectively to keep people from saying what they know about you. I'd love to hear your response.
Thanks. And that's probably where my brief is the most interesting, is on that point. But I think it's so, having studied information policy for so many years now, it's one of the areas that I think is least well developed. Is the property-like aspects of information. It's about time. It's actually beyond time for people to recognize that property, without respect to intellectual property laws, which are a sort of highly developed and sometimes arguably problematic area of information policy, it's high time to recognize that we trade information, we sell information, we retain information to serve all kinds of interests, including our privacy. And it's a reminder, you know, for people to go back to the law school notion of the bundle of sticks, the various rights that comprise property, the right to use, the right to possess, the right to profits, and particularly the right to exclude. That's the dimension of property that the Supreme Court has emphasized. So did Blackstone. That an essence of property is the right to exclude others. With information, the property rights act kind of differently, because you can take a copy of information from someone and they still have the right to possess. They've still got their own copy of it, but what you've taken from them is that right to exclude. Sometimes the right to exclude is the most important part of the property right to them. The Coca-Cola company, for example, is keenly interested in the right to exclude others from the recipe for Coke. So as I'm saying that, I think of how they're monkeying around with their new products, and I might have to come up with a different example for the future. But understanding in detail, in fine detail, about how property rights work in the information environment is important. Your example of a contract to make a bank robbery private that would somehow entitle people to Fourth Amendment protection because they had agreed to keep their conspiracy secret. Well, that's a basic contract question, and it goes to the concept of contracts that are void by public policy. Contracts to enter into criminal behavior, whether it's divvying up the fruits of your crime or keeping your crime secret, those contracts are void. So there isn't a real contract formation there that in ordinary common law. Here, the contracts are devised for the benefit of both parties. The telecom provider needs to use the information for maintaining its network, for serving the customer, marketing purposes, and so on. But the customer has a very keen interest in making sure that the information about their calling, their whereabouts when they're calling, and much more is kept private. So it allocates property rights and data, including, very importantly, the right to exclude, in large part, to the customer. Now, this is backed up in a couple of exemplar ways. One, just take a look at the Federal Trade Commission's enforcement of privacy policies over many years now. Not a huge fan of having a regulatory body do this stuff, but they are actively seeking year over year over year to get companies in the digital area to carry out their promises. They're pursuing these property interests that people have. Likewise, federal regulation in the telecommunications space speaks of consumer proprietary network information. That's the term that Congress created with regard to data about what people do with their phones. It's consumer proprietary network information. They use the word proprietary because this is a property-like thing. The CP&I regs offer up property-like interests and provide, allocate, again, much like the contracts do, allocate property rights. So I think you're right that I'm pushing some ground here. I'm trying to get the court to tread old ground, that is common law contract and property. But I think there's a good argument, and I think this is the only way I know of to administer the Fourth Amendment in a legal way, in a juridical way, as opposed to the sociological way, where it really comes down to, you know, feelings, and the feelings that the Supreme Court can best discern from their guesses about how people live in society.
Great. Let me respond, assuming we have time, with a follow-up. So your argument in response to my hypothetical about the bank robbery is that it would be an illegal contract and therefore void, and therefore under the common law you can't transfer the property interest, and therefore it wouldn't be their record. But in the scenario, just to be clear, you wouldn't tell the person that you're committing a crime. You'd just say, I'll give you $100 to stand here and tell me if a police officer appears. That's not an illegal contract. You're allowed to do that. Or if I'm hiring the getaway driver, I say, here's $100 to sit outside the bank, and don't go anywhere until I come in. I'm going to jump in the back and then take off. That's a perfectly legal contract. So as long as you don't tell the people that your intent is to commit a crime, the contract itself would still be legal, and then it would, I gather, transfer property rights. Is that correct?
Well, given the criminal intent of one party, I think the contract would actually be void ab initio. I think the innocent party would probably maintain, I've made a promise and I have to hold it up. But when it came time to administering a case like that in the court, it would successfully be argued, I think, that the contract did not actually form up because it violated public policy.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess this would hinge on whether the common law of contracts adopts a view that if one party has a criminal intent, that makes the contract voidable. I don't think it does. But if that's the correct textual reading of the Fourth Amendment, that'd be it's interesting. I don't actually think that's the common law rule. Let me agree with you though on one point, which is this is sort of broad sociological questions of what reasonable people think has nothing to do with the Carpenter case, or should have nothing to do with the Carpenter case. I think we're in agreement on that, although for very different reasons. Your view is that because the court should not follow the reasonable expectation of privacy test, and instead to take a textual view. My view is that the reasonable expectation of privacy test is the textual view, actually. It's just trying to figure out whose stuff it is and what counts as a search. It's just a test to figure out when something is sort of sufficiently home-like to count as their person's houses, papers, and effects for Fourth Amendment purposes, but that this case, the Carpenter case, is not about that issue, but is instead about, once assuming there's Fourth Amendment protection, when have you revealed that information to somebody? So, you know, you have Fourth Amendment rights in your information, but hey, you tell the phone company, please connect this call to me, and they are eyewitnesses to what they saw, and therefore you don't have Fourth Amendment rights against once they have said. So I'll agree with you that it shouldn't be this sort of sociological inquiry, but I think for a really different set of reasons than you're offering.
Just for fun, and let's talk about this just a couple minutes before we go to Q&A, which I hope there will be a lot of questions and discussion. I think there's a neat line you can draw all the way back from Ex parte Jackson, which was the case dealing with the Fourth Amendment protection of mail, through Olmstead, through Katz, to modern communications like today's. Ex parte Jackson was as I said, the case that affirmed Fourth Amendment protection for postal mail. And think about this in terms of property rights. So you hand over your mail to a federal agent, giving up your possessory right. But in my opinion, and the court's opinion, though it didn't express it this way, you maintain the right to exclude others from the material that's on the inside of the mail. And the court was clear that open mail matter, such as pamphlets and newspapers, were not Fourth Amendment protected, but those that were sealed were. And that sealing, the aspect of taking printed material and putting it on the inside of opaque material, those papers, is the thing that maintains your Fourth Amendment protection as though it were in the home. There wasn't in Ex parte Jackson a content non-content distinction. I think under Ex parte Jackson, a communication that was written on the outside of an envelope would not be Fourth Amendment protected. Anybody walking past or your mail delivery person could take a look at that, and they wouldn't have violated your Fourth Amendment rights. So it's that rendering of information in written form in this case, and then concealed using paper, that gave it that Fourth Amendment protection. The same thing was going on in Olmstead 50 years later. Olmstead was the case that dealt with wiretapping of bootleggers' telephones. And in this case, it wasn't writing down information and enclosing it in paper, but rather the rendering of the sound of one's voice into an analog electrical signal. So that you know how phones worked in the old days was they converted the sound of one's voice into a modulated analog electrical signal, and that passed invisibly and inaudibly along a wire to be recreated at the other end of the line as that sound again, so that the communications traveled much as mail did, concealed from everyone in between the two. The court got it wrong, and Olmstead is sort of famous for getting it wrong. Chief Justice Taft said that attaching wires to the line and constituting the signal as sound was the use of hearing and hearing alone. That's a pretty odd statement, given how he had earlier in the case described exactly what it takes to gather this information. The better view of that case is Justice Butler's dissent. Everybody talks about Louis Brandeis, who talked about the right to be let alone, and obviously he had written about privacy since his 1890 Harvard Law Review article. But Justice Butler, who was sort of a legal technician, talked about the arrangement that people made with the telephone company, which was essentially to lease the line for the period of time that they were using it. And he said that the communications are something of the parties. They belong to the parties. The communications themselves are something that belong to the party. That's a property-like expression. Fast forward to Katz, and you have, Katz is actually sort of the outlier case, because Katz found that a suitably shrouded spoken word could be a constitutionally protected item. That is, Katz went into a phone booth, concealing from others the sound of his voice, and that was constitutionally protected. The majority argument talks that way. It talks about him going into a phone booth and concealing the sound of his voice from others. Did he establish a property right in his voice? I'm not sure. That's a little more arguable. But then we went off on this tangent because of Justice Harlan's concurrence into privacy expectations. Today we're talking about digital communications. We convert lots of information into a digital form, but much like telephonic communications, it travels invisibly and inaudibly along wires. And to access those things, you have to get yourself next to those wires, or you have to tell the company that is providing that service to the communicator to open their wires to you. So you're getting seizures there, you're getting searches. I think we have to recognize that the contractual regime allocates property rights to the people who are doing the communicating, and thus you have a seizure, you have a search of things that belong to people who are communicating. It's a better way to administer the Fourth Amendment, in my view. I said a couple minutes, and then I ate like 6 minutes just making my little case. But please, if you
let me respond, Jim, because what's interesting is that I completely agree that this is Ex parte Jackson. I agree that Ex parte Jackson is great guidance. I agree with Justice Butler's dissent in Olmstead. So we are exactly together on all the principles here, except we diverge completely on the application to this case. So I read Ex parte Jackson saying the contents of the communication, the actual letter, if it is sealed, it has to be concealed from the mail deliverer. Then you have Fourth Amendment rights in it. If you reveal the information to the mail deliverer, if you haven't paid to make it be first class postal mail, then you don't have any Fourth Amendment rights to that information. If you put it on the outside where the provider, the mail company, can see it, you don't have any Fourth Amendment rights in that information. So the big question in Ex parte Jackson is the cat question. Have you concealed it from someone? And is it a place where, if it is concealed, you have Fourth Amendment rights in it? And Ex parte Jackson is saying, if it's a sealed letter, you've concealed it, and you do have Fourth Amendment rights in that sort of virtual space of the inside of the letter. And I think that's the reasonable expectation of privacy test. So I see Katz's framework, properly understood, Harlan's framework, as exactly agreeing with Ex parte Jackson and Justice Butler's dissent in Olmstead. And as it applies to the Carpenter case, I think it resolves it, because we're not talking about the contents of the communication that were sealed away from the provider. We're instead talking about the information that the provider generated. This is the user saying, I'm over here, please send me this information. I'm here, please, I'm here. And that's information that the phone company is generating about which of its towers were used to route that call. That's information which in the Ex parte Jackson framework is like the outside of the envelope. It's information that has been revealed to the provider in order to enable the provider to deliver the communication. So I would say under the Ex parte Jackson framework that that's information revealed, no manifesting of a subjective expectation of privacy, and therefore no Fourth Amendment rights under Ex parte Jackson, and also Justice Butler's dissent in Olmstead.
Let's move now to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone.
When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer any questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you'd like to request, have a question you'd like to ask our experts, please enter the star key, then the pound key on your telephone. It looks like we have three questions in the queue. Let's move to our first audience question.
You know, this is an excellent discussion, and you may have already answered these questions, but let me put this in a slightly different context. When you buy a Tesla, you give Tesla the authority to download all of your vehicle data at regular intervals so that they can theoretically improve the quality of their product. Every Tesla owner is a beta tester of their product. The written agreement you sign says the Tesla can turn this over upon request to a law enforcement person. How would you analyze Carpenter in light of Tesla's possession of data? Is it any different?
As you're asking the question, I'm going to look up Tesla's privacy policy and see if I can find the precise language. But if it's like most privacy policies, it permits the sharing of data with government entities thanks to legal process, that is a subpoena, warrant, or other legal process. My argument is that legal has two senses, both of which are relevant. One is that it has to be a recognized procedure that we talk about as legal. The Stored Communications Act establishes a recognized procedure for trying to gather this data. The other is that it has to be legal. That is, it has to satisfy the standards that exist in the law. Now, if you can read that one way as saying, well, we've got a congressional statute here that will presume to be the correct take on this, then the Tesla or the other digital service provider sort of has blanket authority to hand the data over. But I think that's the wrong presumption to make. The right presumption, the presumption that actually makes that a complete contract term, is to allow the customer the power to contest the handing over of the data. In a case like this, a criminal case, you can't invite the customer to participate during the investigation stage, and so the most prudent thing to do is to require a neutral arbiter, and the warrant requirement is perfect for that.
Yeah, and to give a different take. Well, first of all, I would say I'm having a little trouble understanding the hypothetical, and maybe the best thing to do would be, sir, for you to buy me a Tesla so I could drive it for a couple of years and then really understand the true meaning of the hypothetical. I'd be happy to do that if you'd like. You can email me. I think this is the difficulty once you say that you can reveal information to somebody but then have Fourth Amendment rights against the disclosure of that information. What's the test that determines when you have privacy rights in that? You know, I want to rob a bank with somebody. I start telling them information. You know, the government wants them to testify against me. Do they need a warrant to do that? I just have trouble trying to figure out what the test is. And in response to Jim's specific argument about the word legal, I gather, you know, under his theory, we're just dealing with a contract question. It's just pure contractual interpretation. What is legal process? There's no sort of grand philosophy behind it. It's just what was the agreement between these two private parties? And I would just think that following a federal legal process, if it says, you know, a subpoena, then it means a subpoena. It says, you know, legal process, a court order would ordinarily count as legal process. It doesn't say only pursuant to a warrant, which I gather it would need to for that. And I just think it's problematic to allow private parties to, you know, change their privacy policies in ways that are going to determine government rights to investigate cases, because, you know, you can imagine, what do you do if a group is sort of interested in committing crimes using services like cell phones? They go with the group that has the privacy policy that says we won't turn over the information under any circumstances, even pursuant to a warrant. And then that becomes, I guess, legally binding, and requires the government to at least get a warrant, maybe more than a warrant. I don't exactly know. And I think that's problematic to introduce that.
Yeah, I mean, well, here's the privacy policy of Tesla. It says,
In brief, the Tesla privacy policy says, with other third parties when required by law. So that I don't want to parse the Tesla privacy policy because we don't have the time to do all that. But a warrant always defeats contractual requirements. So you could have a contractual obligation from a legitimate, you know, ordinary business provider that says, we do not share your data with anyone. That's a perfectly fine contract to enter into, but they would have to respond to the warrant requirement. Let's put the context here, of course, is that we're talking about the cellular telecommunications companies that serve all Americans, and they enjoy the benefit of the presumption of innocence. So there isn't a sort of a contract term in AT&T's privacy policy or T-Mobile's or Metro PCS or any other that is there to facilitate criminality. Now, it may facilitate criminality because, well, you have plenty of alternatives. We will publish all cell phone user data to anyone who requests law enforcement or not. That would make our cell phone use much more transparent, and it would suppress criminal use of cell phones, but that would not be appropriate in terms of our collective demand for privacy. And by the way, if you're looking around for reasonable expectations of privacy, why not go to the very contracts that set those expectations in a distributed way across the society? It's those contract terms that people can actually expect to see carried out, but instead the courts will tend to think for themselves what the expectations are. It's right there in the privacy policy. It says that, you know, this only gets shared when the law requires it, and that's, I think, the right place to draw the line.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. We currently have three questions in the queue. Let's move to our next caller.
Hi, this is Chris Green at Ole Miss Law School. I'm curious if any state courts interpreting Fourth Amendment analogs have said anything interesting on any of these issues.
Yeah, so state courts, most state courts have agreed with the third-party doctrine. Some have not. I think specifically on cell site cases, in a specific cell site context, some have required a warrant under state law, the state constitution, and others have not. I think it's kind of a mixed record. One question, there's a really interesting debate over what to make of that. You know, do state constitutional law decisions inform the federal Fourth Amendment? Should they? Is it sort of helpful information? And I think one way in which you can't draw that equivalence is that because of the supremacy clause, the states can't bind the federal investigators. And, of course, the Fourth Amendment binds both federal and state under Wolf versus Colorado and Matt versus Ohio. So you end up with kind of a one-way street, and what tends to happen when states impose particularly strong regulations on investigators of their states, cases get passed up to the federal government where those state laws are not followed. This is, for example, something that's happening, from what I understand, in California, which enacted the California Electronic Communications Privacy Act, imposing very strong privacy protections against state investigations. That was statutory, not constitutional, but same. Also just imposing the rule on the states. And so you're having cases that would have been investigated at the state level get popped up to the federal level for investigation. So it's kind of hard, I think, to draw an equivalence between the state rule and the federal rule because of the different roles, different kinds of cases they're investigating, and also the fact that they can pass off cases from one to the other. But it just to answer the question directly, I think it's a mixed record with some courts recognizing state equivalent to the Fourth Amendment rights against state investigations, and others not doing so.
Thanks.
I don't have any additional information, but I endorse the question. Independent state grounds is a great great thing to do. Is look at what state Supreme Courts are doing. Thanks, Chris.
Cool.
Thank you for your question.
Hello, gentlemen. This is Ken Cuccinelli calling from Virginia. Appreciate the discussion and was curious of your reflections looking back at the Jones case where you had a 5-4 decision for dissenters and Sotomayor, whose concurrence joining the majority seemed to suggest there were 5 votes even then for a review of the third party doctrine in light of the digital era and the changes in how we view papers, things, and so forth, or at least how some of us do, and would appreciate your thoughts on that. That's sort of a nuts and bolts of the justices.
I appreciate the question, Ken. The Jones case, and maybe Justice Sotomayor's quote is the most cited thing. I don't have the numbers to prove it, but she made a very good case that the third party doctrine is. If it wasn't already out of step when it was founded, it's far out of step with the way we live our lives today. We transact so much online that's being shared with our ISPs and various service providers, such as search engines, but also medical providers and financial services providers and so on. The whole of our personality, our decisions, our marital life, our religion is reflected in data that we're sharing with third parties. So there's a sort of it can't possibly be that the third party doctrine works. And there are plenty of examples where the court isn't applying the third party doctrine. It's sort of a dog that doesn't bark in a lot of cases. In Riley, for example, the case finding that you needed a warrant to search a cell phone, there was no discussion of whether data on the cell phone might already have been shared with third party cloud services providers. So the third party doctrine kind of pokes its head in from time to time. But I don't know that it's a sound doctrine. I learned from Oren that none of the current justices were actually on the court when a third-party doctrine case has been decided. So I suspect it's not long for this world. And the question is where the court will go from here. And I'm hoping that it moves to a more textual approach rather than a sociological approach like reasonable expectations.
Yeah, and I have it's a great question, Ken. I have a different answer, I think. At GW Law School, when we had Justice Sotomayor preside over the moot court a few years ago, and we wrote the question based on her concurring opinion in Jones. So it would be interesting to see what Justice Sotomayor would do with the mosaic theory. And I believe it actually was a cell phone case that we gave her. And in the Q&A or commentary after the moot court, she was saying in response to the parties that argued in favor of the mosaic approach, really using her concurring opinion, she said, "You don't have a lot to rely on. It was just me. I'm only one person. There's a long way to go before any of this becomes actual law." And I'm paraphrasing, although I do have the quote written down. I blogged about it at the Vola Conspiracy. So I don't think the court had 5 votes to enact to reject the third-party doctrine, which, after all, was not actually implicated by the facts of the Jones case. So I suspect that this is an issue that actually most of the justices just have never thought deeply about, have never really contemplated, like, where are we going here? And I should add that if you take the view that the third-party doctrine should not apply in the digital world because so much of what we do can be revealed by non-content information, that also raises the possibility that the Fourth Amendment is going to start to apply in the physical world in public because the non-content records that you generate in the network world are just the information equivalent of what you do outside. And I would say most of us would probably say, I can't live my life without going outside. I can't spend the entire day inside and never leave. And so maybe that should mean, you know, taking that reasoning against the third-party doctrine, maybe that should mean you have Fourth Amendment rights when you walk outside, that if somebody wants to walk outside, they have a right not to be watched by the police.
Yeah, but Oren, haven't you haven't you gone one step too far there? I mean, taking a simple outside rule with respect to the Fourth Amendment, if the police can observe it, like your license plate when you drive off your property, for instance, then the envelope, it's one thing, but you can't observe digital information. It's not commonly observable, even if you can find it. If you can, you're not common. Most people can't find it, but it is findable.
Well, your digital information is actually the easiest to find. Go to your provider that has all of it. It's a lot easier to reconstruct that information than it is to reconstruct.
Yeah, but most people can't do
that.
Oren, you're indulging in a thing that a lot of computer science people tell us that, oh, you fools, you're sending email in the clear. Well, we are fools.
No. I'm not making that argument at all.
Email in the clear is only in the clear to people that are on the network, and people on that network are the service provider itself or people working for it, et cetera, et cetera. When you go outside, let's talk about this in terms of property, you are abandoning for all to see the fact that you are wearing a hat, the fact that you're on
unless,
the
unless you've contracted with them to keep that private.
And that doesn't happen. Right. I mean, I could attempt to make contracts with everybody I encounter on the street to withhold information about my having been on the street. I think the cost of that would be very high relative to the benefit, and I wouldn't do it. So going out on the street is not like interacting with a telecommunication service provider to send an email or place a call for me. That's subject to contractual terms and regulatory terms that require them not to share that information with other people as a matter of course. Those contracts are pretty consistent across the digital domain. They're important for the protection of ordinary users because our communications with our loved ones, with our religious leaders, our medical providers, psychologists, lawyers, are all revealed by that kind of information. So these are solid, appropriate terms of service that, if the law is a seamless web, should also be part of the consideration as to whether the government can access them without a warrant.
Yeah, let me be a little clearer, though, because I think my point may have been misunderstood. I understood the argument against the third-party doctrine to be based on this idea of that you should have to live in a world in which information that you do in the course of a day is protected by the Fourth Amendment, because you have to communicate with these networks, and you have to send emails, and you have to do all these things, and we shouldn't live in a world where all this information about you is not protected by the Fourth Amendment. That is one of the, I think, is one of the significant arguments against the third party doctrine. And I'm just merely pointing out that if that applies in the network space, then it's not obvious why that doesn't apply in the physical world. This is actually a big issue that came up in the Jones litigation, especially in the DC circuit, where if you say monitoring somebody over a period of time becomes a search, does that also apply to physical surveillance? And the DC circuit refused to take a view on that. And so it may be, to go back to the earlier point, yeah, you know, when you walk out of the world, you waive your rights, but not over time. That would be the argument of Carpenter's brief, that once someone's watching you over, the government is watching you over a long period of time or collecting records that occur over a long period of time, then that becomes a collective mosaic search. And maybe you disagree with that view, but it strikes me as that principle that the Fourth Amendment must protect things that are important to the to how you live your life. If we apply that in the digital world, it's not obvious why we shouldn't apply that also in the physical world.
And I took your, I heard you characterizing the third-party doctrine that way in your setup, and it's an interesting point. I don't think that the third-party doctrine really matters when you're talking about strangers, people I run into on the street, people who see the book that I'm carrying, people who overhear a conversation because I'm talking too loud. Those are all third parties, but I don't think there's any claim that they should be restricted from repeating the information that they learn from what they observe in public. But when you're talking about third-party service providers who are under contractual obligations, regulatory obligations, we're even talking about some who are fiduciaries, the whole doctrine arose in the area of financial services, where confidentiality has been a hallmark pretty much forever. Those are third parties where I think it's inappropriate for there to be some blanket rule that, just like strangers who you encounter on the street, they can turn around despite their promises and obligations and report that to law enforcement without overcoming some kind of legal process, and I think it should be a warrant.
Thank you for your question. We have one question left in the queue before we end Q&A. Before we get to that question, just would like to announce that our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday, August 15th at 1 p.m. Eastern. We have the honor to host Maureen Olhausen, Acting Chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, to discuss patents and antitrust worldwide. Please keep an eye out for these emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. You can see the full schedule on our website, fedsoc.org, as well as a list of all previously recorded Teleforms as podcasts that you can stream through your browser or download to any of your devices. Let's move now to our final question.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Giovanni Johnson. I'm speaking from Dallas, Texas. Here's my question. Many products and services out on the market today usually include a clause in their terms of use or privacy policy that they must share their data with an authorized third party as required by law, such as Tesla, as you guys had mentioned earlier. If the third party is the federal government or other party is required by law, how much risk in terms of data being lost to unauthorized parties or to have that data being used to be charged a crime against myself or others do we incur by allowing our data to be used for a typical service such as a bank or cellular carrier?
Well, how much risk is a hard question to answer because I don't know if you can quite put a number on it. But under the interpretation of the Fourth Amendment that I argue for, your risk would drop quite a bit because in the ordinary contract language that requires a solid basis for gathering information, that is, you are protected unless the government meets that probable cause standard, your risk would drop dramatically. Right now, thanks to the third-party doctrine, your risk is relatively high because it is arguable whether or not your ISP, your search engine, so on and so forth, has to respond to a law enforcement requests that don't meet the legal standards. So I think you're right to be concerned about it because I think things are pretty sloppy right now. The best way we have to administer what should and should not happen in this area is a bottom-up approach, and that's the contract law approach. We have contracts across the digital domain, terms of service and privacy policies that make representations about what happens with data, and those should be regarded as real representations, real contracts that are enforceable and that give us rights, including property rights and data, the most important of which is the right to exclude. So thanks for your question, and thanks to the Federalist Society, Oren, Wes, and everybody listening in. Sure appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim and Oren. Thank you very much, caller, for your question. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.